Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 713. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois. I just returned from a trip out to Rockport, Maine to visit Lakeview Presbyterian Church for the Ministerial Training Institute of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. I had a delightful time last week meeting with brothers and sisters in Christ, talking about many important things regarding OPC history, as well as there was a course offered titled Disability and the Church, which was taught by the Reverend Stephen J. Tracy, who's the pastor there, one of the pastors at Lakeview Presbyterian Church, as well as some other people that were brought in, I believe, from Johnny and Friends and some other places. So a delightful opportunity for people to come and to learn about an important aspect of church life that often goes underappreciated or does not given the attention that it needs in our congregations. So if you'd like more information about that particular course or would like to learn what was taught and maybe find some resources that you might use in your local church, even though you were unable to attend this course or didn't know about it, you can head on over to opc.org and find information. But if you'd like a shortcut and would like to contact somebody directly, you can email us at mail@reformedforum.org and we'll try to set you up. Now, I was present specifically for the OPC history course, which was taught by Mr. John R. Meether. You will know him as Professor of Church History and Dean of Libraries at RTS, specifically there in Orlando. And for the last 22 years or so, at least up until this most recent July, he served as the historian for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, succeeding Charlie Dennison in that role. John served over 20 years in that role and had done a fine job. And in July, he had asked to step down from that particular position and was nominated and moved over to serve as a member of the committee for the historian. But they decided to nominate me, and I was willing to serve, and now I'm serving as the historian of the OPC. So seeing that someday I'll probably end up teaching the OPC history course for the Ministerial Training Institute, I thought it would be wise at least for me to take the course and to participate with John Meether teaching and facilitating the course. So that's why I was out in Maine. And who wouldn't want to go to Maine in August, and who wouldn't want to spend time with these guys and just fellowshipping and talking about church history? I mean, to me, that's just the greatest thing ever. So I had a wonderful time out there, and taking the course with John was spectacular. And of course, Danny Olinger joined us for a conversation. He's the General Secretary for the Committee on Christian Education for the OPC, as well as the President for the Committee for the Historian. So we had a bit of an impromptu discussion. We had kind of sketched out some things we'd like to talk about, and we knew we would set aside time to record a podcast episode. However, we just kind of were going at it, and you'll notice that. We just had a wonderful kind of free-flowing conversation about the Committee of Nine, which is a specific thing in OPC history, 1941 and 1942, but it has application not only for Orthodox Presbyterians or even American Presbyterians, but for the church at large and how it might relate to the culture. So if you are interested in any of those things, and you should be, because I think there are some universal lessons to be learned from the specific instance of the Committee of Nine in early OP history, then certainly pay attention, listen, and certainly I imagine you will learn some lessons that will be useful for you down the road, lessons to be learned so that we are not doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past down the road into the future. One little bit of housekeeping regarding things are available online. You can head over to reformedforum.org/store, and you'll see that we also now have bulk copies of Lane Tipton's book, Foundations of Covenant Theology. These are available in packs of 10, and you'll receive up to a 42% discount over the cost of individual copies if you buy a box of 10 of them. And so that's a wonderful deal. And also very soon, I don't have them yet, but I'm expecting a shipment of USB 3.0 thumb drives that have our logo on them. They're 64 gigabyte drives. So once I receive those, I will begin loading the videos from the companion course onto a thumb drive, including all the PDF handouts. So in the near future, maybe by the time that you watch or listen to this, you will be able to go to our online store and buy a ready-made Bible study Sunday school kit, which would be one single box that includes 10 copies of the book, as well as a USB thumb drive with all the digital resources that you require. Of course, you can take the course and stream it online for free. You can download the PDF handouts and print them out already, but having it in a convenient package on a thumb drive can often be nice, especially for a Sunday school class where you don't necessarily have access to really fast Wi-Fi, or you just don't want to fiddle with streaming on a computer. You can just plug a thumb drive into your computer, hook that computer up to a television or a projector, or a computer that's hooked to a projector, and just watch the videos in that regard. No internet required. So that's a useful thing, we think. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, would like to get a ready-made box of a course in a box, then head over to reformedforum.org/store for information on that. And of course, the easiest way to stay up to date with what we're doing is by subscribing to our email newsletter, reformedforum.org. At the bottom of the page, almost many of the pages, you'll find a little form. You can just type in your email address and subscribe, and then you'll be updated when all of these new things occur and when they are released. So back to the episode today. We're going to go back to a previous version of myself, me talking with Danny Olinger and John Meether about OPC church history, but of course with wider application for the church at large. And I had a delightful time, a wonderful conversation. We hope you enjoy it. So pay attention. Stay tuned. I mean, looking back through some of the early Orthodox Presbyterian history, one thing that popped up reading some accounts, we have many different publications. We have Confident in Better Things. We have different articles and things written and produced by the Committee for the Historian. But one that stuck out to me the most of late, the last 6 months, is, of course, the book you edited with David Thompson, History for a Pilgrim People, which is shorter writings of Charlie Dennison, who was previously the Orthodox Presbyterian Church historian, I guess, two historians ago. John, here, our guest, was previously a historian just up until several weeks ago, and now me. But that book addresses quite a few things. There are some extremely significant writings in that book. And for people who haven't read it, I believe they should get a copy, and hopefully maybe someday we can get that back in print in one way, shape, or form. At least make it accessible in one way, shape, or form. And Charlie has a three-piece series that began as lectures at Mid-America Reform Seminary. What was the date on that, 92?
Yes.
And he divides up OPC history into three segments, and up to 92, of course, and three representative figures. And that series is titled something to the effect of Tragedy, Hope, and Ambivalence. And so you have the figure representing the tragic era of J. Gresham Machen, and Hope represented by Cornelius Van Til, and Ambivalence represented by Ned Stonehouse. If you're wondering why Stonehouse is ambivalence, you read the articles and present that. But one thing that came up to me that I hadn't spent much time learning about is this interesting time of the church in the early 40s with something called the Committee of Nine. And I'd like to talk about that today, and we can discuss what that was and what its significance was for the church and specifically for Orthodox Presbyterian identity. But it has great application just for evangelical churches and other NAEPARC denominations. I'm thinking specifically of the PCA. You're going to find tensions within the PCA that will resonate or find some sort of application touch point with some of the same types of things going on with the Committee of Nine. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Even to back up even further, there's a figure that might loom large in this that might not go noticed initially, and that's Paul Woolley. I don't want to jump on your case too fast, John, but you've got this tremendous chapter in Confident in Better Things titled The Significance of Paul Woolley Today. And Paul Woolley wrote a tremendous article
Perhaps you can remind me of the date, 46-ish, or he wrote Discontent. And we had a years ago, we did an episode on Christ the Center about Woolley's article, Discontent. So Woolley, to begin with, and then kind of commenting on this type of event in church history, we can use him as perhaps bookends to this middle ground of the Committee of Nine. We can talk about who was Paul Woolley and kind of what was he all about?
Yeah, Paul Woolley was one of the original faculty members at Westminster Seminary. He came on as the registrar, and he served for a long time as faculty secretary. He was, in some respects, de facto the president at a school which didn't have a president. And he was the chief administrative officer, I guess is how we would call it today in the vernacular of modern businesses. He the article you refer to was written in 1944. The church is 8 years old, and he's chronicling the different sorts of discontent that manifested itself in the young church from Carl McIntyre to Ed Ryan. And Ed Ryan gets into the ambitions of the Committee of Nine, which Woolley was not a part of, but Woolley certainly shared the convictions that Van Til had on that committee. Woolley was known to be something of a curmudgeon. He was he was frequently a voice of dissent, a minority of one sometimes. He was known to, I guess it was true at Westminster as it is in most seminary faculties, that a faculty meeting rarely commands your full attention. When I was briefly in the faculty at Westminster, I noticed faculty members were grading papers during faculty meetings and other sorts of things. Woolley would read the New York Times. And often, in the midst of a very mundane motion that was before the body, Woolley looked like he wasn't paying a bit of attention, but when it came time to a vote, he would just register his negative vote just for the sake of being different sometimes.
The lone voice.
Yeah. he was a brilliant administrator, so much so, in fact, that when Fuller Seminary was founded in 1947, Harold Akinkay tried to entice him to leave Westminster to be the administrator of Fuller, and he declined out of loyalty to Westminster. But his gifts were certainly recognized by many. In fact, one of the greatest stories Grace Mullen used to tell, you remember the Percy Crawford story? Percy Crawford was a leading televangelist, I guess a radio evangelist for some time. And at one point, Percy Crawford attended Westminster Seminary. And the reason he attended Westminster Seminary had everything to do with Paul Woolley. Crawford applied to several seminaries, and he determined that the sign from the Lord of the seminary he would attend would be displayed by the first school that would respond to him. Well, Woolley was in the habit of responding to correspondence the day he received it.
Never let the sun go down on his correspondence,
right? So he easily bested the competition. And that was all the sign that Percy Crawford needed to attend Westminster Seminary.
The Lord still speaks today.
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah.
So he is well known for just his administrative chops. It just was how he was wired, right? But he was an independent thinker, right?
Vigorously independent.
Vigorously.
Yes, yes. He was a member of organizations that would lead contemporary listeners scratching their heads. He was a member of the ACLU.
A Jewish liberal organization to begin with, was it not? I mean, it began amongst Jews as it wasn't advocating for the types of things it often advocates today.
Correct. He was also a member of what was then called Protestants and Other Protestants and Others committed to the separation of church and Protestants and Other Americans united for the separation of church and state. This was actually formed in the late 1950s when mainline Protestants were fearful of what would happen soon, namely the election of a Roman Catholic president. Now, neither the ACLU or the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State were then the vigorously secularist organizations they are today. So it would be anachronistic to imagine Woolley would embrace the agenda of those organizations today. But it showed how he was on the cutting edge in a lot of respects politically, even by membership of those organizations back then.
Would it be fair to characterize him as a libertarian?
Absolutely.
And how similar was he to Machen, or where might he diverge, can we tell?
A lot of similarities there. Machen's was likely born more from a Southern states' rights orientation. But I think in terms of their political sensibilities, they were very closely aligned.
Now, Woolley was professor of church history.
That's right.
Was he the sole professor for a few years?
For many years, until Claire Davis came, I think, in the 60s. I think he taught the complete gamut of church history at Westminster.
Had time to do that and all the other administrative things he did?
Right. What it didn't give time to do, and what he wasn't able to commit to, was an extensive writing career.
But I think you make the point that's not exactly true. I mean, it is true in terms of books and maybe larger articles, but he wrote vociferously in The Guardian.
I think he wrote for The Guardian, and I think he wrote up to nearly 100 reviews in the Westminster Journal. I think he wrote more reviews than any other contributor. So he was engaged in all the major voices in church history.
He might have been, in our history, the person who penned the most anonymous editorials, pamphlets. He was not self-seeking. And you actually can go back in the Christian Ed minutes and you'll ask who wrote this pamphlet, and you find out, oh, it was Woolley. He just didn't put his name on it.
And something else Woolley wrote anonymously that few people are aware of, Great Commission Publications would produce these templates for church bulletins that often had a very thought-provoking article in the back, unsigned. Mm. I remember as a kid I would read these things. I was impressed with how thoughtful these things were. And it turned out Woolley was the writer for most of those.
He wasn't exactly a copy editor or a copywriter, I should say, but he would have been content with that role.
Oh, I think he was such a perfectionist that he could have edited any magazine.
Meaning in the role of writing copy and not necessarily getting the recognition for it. Yeah. Woolley, from our perspective now, looking back at the whole of his life, and perhaps we can discuss discontent a bit, but maybe it's even wiser to speak about some of its what gave birth to it. But what would you say, what is the significance of Paul Woolley for today? To answer the question you raise in the chapter title from 2011, Confident in Better Things, how is he a useful historical figure for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, but more significantly just the Reformed and Presbyterian confessional churches today?
I think he was careful to... He offers a caution against aligning the church with the political movements of our age, and he was he showed in his life, in his writings, how Reformed confessionalism doesn't automatically naively align with the political winds of doctrine that are in the air. He was just very thoughtful about what Reformed confessionalism does not entail in political life.
Danny, there are other factors in Woolley's. What would you say about his interaction and experience in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church? Other things of note that are useful to know about Woolley as a representative figure?
I'm always taken by the fact during the controversy in 1936-37 over eschatology that Woolley, although he was historic pre-mill, did not side with the dispensationalists and was very supportive of Machen and R.B. Kuyper and John Murray in regard to what they were arguing from, particularly in regard to the confessional basis And I just, the tremendous integrity that really, I think, shone through in that episode. And also just his loyalty to the cause. I mean, he was just thoroughly committed. But like John said, it wasn't a political, cultural stance. And I've sometimes wondered what his marriage in regard to Mrs. Woolley was Russian nobility. And she had seen, you know, relatives die and was living in exile, I believe, when they met. And I always wondered if that had an impact upon him in seeing what happens, you know, governments change. And but the church, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that, you know, the church should be grounded upon Christ. So I've always wondered about that. But I've heard great stories about Lenny Woolley and her aristocratic demeanor, from the old time Westminster and OPC people.
I would add one more thing too, in terms of his contribution to the historical sensibilities of the OPC. The OPC is often described as a church that merges two great Reformed traditions, the Dutch Reformed tradition and Scottish Presbyterianism, and that's embodied in Van Til and John Murray preeminently. Woolley is a reminder not to forget the American Presbyterian antecedents to the OPC story, and he was well versed on the issues that prompted the in American Presbyterianism, things that we've discussed this week in our class about that shaped the character of the OPC. He's aware of the fault lines that existed from earlier debates in American Presbyterianism, how these debates are as old as American Presbyterianism, and how they come to bear on the challenges before the OPC today.
I'm picking up a thread on Murray and Woolley, and you mentioned as premillennialism, not dispensationalist. He was historic premillennialist. But I've always, of late, have found this fascinating that Murray was writing this series of what did he say? There were issues or problems with the fundamentalist,
the Reformed faith and its modern substitutes.
Modern substitutes,
right?
And one of which is premillennialism, specifically dispensationalist, but still other forms of premillennialism too. I'm curious how Woolley would have interpreted these critiques from his own faculty colleague.
Well, I think he got along great with Murray and respected his exegesis, mm-hmm. but that same independent streak that. Woolley did not mind being the sole voice in a boat. It didn't bother him to be the sole historic pre-mill on the faculty. But I thought he had a very, very good relationship with Murray. And that's one thing that, my mentor, Charlie Dennis, when I came into the OPC, I would see Charlie on the floor of a presbytery meeting or general assembly really debating hard. Really aggressive and hard, and then having great fellowship with the very individuals that he had just debated hard. That's the sense I get that Woolley was not offended, really showed what I think John's on. It was very correct in regard to he's really the embodiment of the American Presbyterian antecedent in its best form, and much like a Warfield form or a Hodge form, but in the courage of his convictions. But he was so erudite too. He was good friends with Gerhardus Voss, and I think part of that was the tremendous book learning, just widely read on so many different subjects. And so conversant, and so I think he's just the type of guy. I think when Machen found Woolley, it's like he knew he had gotten a treasure that was going to give everything he had to the institution, and also being a churchman to the church. And so Woolley's it's a 50-year service that was probably most appreciated by those who knew how much lifting he was doing behind the scenes. Mm. He was never seeking out the spotlight.
And back to the dispensational issue, this was an issue early in the life of the OPC, Westminster Seminary, and in Woolley's career. It comes back again at the very end of Woolley's career.
Yes.
The very last General Assembly he attends and where he votes is the 1975 Assembly that is voting on a union with the RPCES, which in some respects was a reuniting with these premillennialist elements that had left the OPC in 1937. And Woolley believed that there were still some unresolved issues there that made it premature to unite. And so he cast his vote against that vote, even though it would have meant bringing in those of some greater theological affinity with him.
He was the only, so there was probably 5 to 6 Westminster Seminary faculty, OPC ministers who were at that assembly, and he's the only one who votes against the merger. The rest of the faculty votes for the merger. Yeah. But he, and that's, again, that's the amazing thing about Woolley is that one would think the modifications that the RPCES would make for eschatological liberty, that Woolley, if thinking his own view might gain greater acceptance, he still confessionally thought it was a bad thing to do, and both wrote about it and voted against it. And it's interesting, an ally he had in that was Meredith Klein. And Meredith Klein, at the same time, was writing articles about premillennialism and amillennialism, and it was attacking very fiercely the sense that to do this was so to make this compromise, to allow this, was so contrary to the eschatology of the Bible that the Reformed faith should think about this very seriously. It's when he was writing those articles on Revelation 20 and the first resurrection in the journal.
Let's go back then to the early 40s to discuss this Committee of Nine, because there are several threads, I think, that are interesting to pick up and that we see kind of coming in and out of Woolley's life. And Woolley as a representative figure he gives us an entree or an entry point into different things regarding the denomination. But one of those is something you mentioned earlier, his affinity for what has been called by some opponents the alien influence in the church, meaning non-Americans, specifically the Dutch, but also to some extent John Murray. There had been a thread of people that were a part of the fundamentalist cause, but yet were part of it for perhaps different reasons than others who stuck with the OPC after its founding. Could you speak to some of that at all? I mean, some of the latent national aspects or some of the American aspects that were kind of somehow coincident with fundamentalism for so many people.
Well, yeah, it might be helpful to observe, first of all, if anyone could claim to be the Americanist, the most American of the founding fathers of the OPC, Woolley could make some claim. Here's an Ivy League educated, as you said, very erudite man, went to Brown. Is that right? I think he went to Brown.
Yeah.
And
no one ever saw without a jacket and tie, never.
Right, right.
I mean, you could talk to his ex-students, never ever would they see him without a jacket and a tie. That type of cultural aspect.
Yeah, so if anyone embodied these visually, the Presbyterian elite.
It would have been him.
It was Paul Woolley.
Wow.
And yet he was willing to forsake that all to join the cause at Westminster. But the one who had the aspirations was of course, Ed Ryan, who sought as much as he would claim to be part of Machen's cause. He was one who aspired to the very sort of political elitism that Woolley didn't care to pursue. And he was certainly one of the dissenters whom Woolley had in mind in his 1944 article. Now, Danny, you know, you remember more than I do about the conditions under which the Committee of Nine was formed. It was an impression that the OPC wasn't giving sufficient attention to the role it could play in influencing having a larger a voice in public life,
and evangelical witness to some degree too. I mean, that was under its auspices somewhat.
Yeah,
a warmth and a attractiveness, I suppose.
Right. So Edwin Ryan had been, you know, a confidant of Machen's, and when Machen ends up dying, he's one of the figures that then rises to leadership in the OPC, and he has the unique role of being the president of the board of trustees at Westminster Seminary. And even though the institution was independent of the church, there still was this really close relationship in which this was where every single minister was graduating from. There was no other seminary. This was it. They all knew one another. And so Ryan had a vested interest in regard to keeping that relationship strong. And but he also wanted to maybe I could backtrack a little bit. Talking about Paul Woolley, and Paul Woolley had this cultural aspect, elite aspect. That's exactly what Ed Ryan aspired to. So much so that Ed Ryan tried to erase from the record that he attended Moody Bible Institute because he did not want that to, you know, be on his record. And so he had it erased. And so, like, in further biographical sketches, you'll find no trace of that. But he went there. So that's, you know, Ryan was aspiring to something, and he had a pipeline going at Wheaton College. So in the first 5 years of the OPC, first 6 years, nearly 40% of the ministers went from Wheaton College to Westminster Seminary and then were ordained in the OPC. And the reason being that the president of Wheaton College from 1926 to 1940 was J. Oliver Buswell, one of Machen's great friends. And Buswell had been the moderator of the Second General Assembly, famously nominated by Cornelius Van Til. But at the Third General Assembly, Buswell, being a dispensationalist, ends up on the other side, leaving the OPC to form the Bible Presbyterian Synod. Well, by 1940, Buswell gets kicked out of the presidency of Wheaton College, but Ryan still had a feeder at Wheaton College, and that was Professor Gordon Clark. And so Gordon Clark now was, and he had been, Clark had come on the faculty in 36, and he had been providing a feeder system to Westminster. But by 1942, a special committee at Wheaton had been formed, and Clark knew he was on the skids. They were going to get rid of him too, because both Buswell and Clark were seen as being too Calvinistic. And so this is happening the same time that the OPC is finally emerging from just utter poverty. Few churches have ever been as poor as the OPC in 1938. We had less than $900 for all of our missionaries, home and foreign missions. We were paying our missionaries, you know, like 40 cents on the dollar, and even then they were only getting like $300, $400 a year. We were paying our church planners so little that they were often getting by on potatoes and apples that the people give. So that's why in August of 1938, when the ruling came down that we had to change our original name from the Presbyterian Church of America. We didn't have any money to fight it. And then, yes, and so on February 9th, 1939, at the Fifth General Assembly, we changed the name to the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Well, see, Ryan, during this period, has to, so on the one hand, Ryan is still getting the students to come to Westminster, but the OPC, after 1939, you know, with that new name, was on the skids. But by 1940, 1941, it had stabilized. It actually grown a tiny little bit in membership, and Ryan saw his opportunity. And so he went after it in two ways in 1941, very audacious. And the one way was spectacular. He publishes the book, The Presbyterian Conflict, one of the great books about the controversy in the Presbyterian Church. Now, in recent times, there's been wonderful research that he probably lifted the majority of that manuscript from Machen.
Right. And you could read Jim. We've talked to Jim Scott about this on the program. If you'd like to read a two-part series in the Westminster Theological Journal, I'll try to include bibliographic references to that if you're curious. But that those two articles read like a fantastic thriller mystery novel.
Yeah. so that aside, the book is incredible. Right. Whether he lifted it or not, it's one of the most important books. And very crucial to the history of the OPC. That really propped us up to have that book come out. The second thing was at this time, the evangelical world was all abuzz because the National Association of Evangelicals was about to get off the ground. Mm-hmm. And Ryan is utterly connected. Because again, he's the president of the board of Westminster and he wants the students to come in, and so he's angling for the OPC to enter that. And so he has this idea, knowing how deliberate the OPC is, particularly in the mindset of those who had been through the trials of Machen, in which it had just been railroaded through and the previous question had been moved over and over. So he knew the OPC, it was not going to be something he could just probably do on the floor. So he puts forth this motion that the OPC would have a committee of nine that would work, this committee would study the relationship of the witness of the OPC to the broader world, to think about the communication that it uses, to think about the evangelistic method it uses, with the goal of not only he wants the OPC to expand, but he's also angling for us to get in the NAE. He wants us to join. So he actually has that motion pass in 1941 at the General Assembly. But here's the amazing thing, too. He gets almost every single person he wants on it. I mean, the people that are fully supportive of his agenda, he packs that committee with.
It was pre-worked out.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like if you show up there, the assembly was at Westminster Seminary. And so if you show up there and Ryan has this idea and, no one's really speaking against it. And then he not only nominates, but he has other guys nominated. He gets the committee packed. So he gets five guys that he absolutely wants on it. Himself, Gordon Clark, Robert Strong, Clifford Smith, and Burton Goddard were all totally in his court. But he couldn't get all nine. And it's the two that he couldn't get that ended up being the thorn in his flesh. And that was Cornelius Van Til got in this committee, and also Murray Forrest Thompson, who had written so powerfully against what had happened when the OPC had formed. So these were two men that, to use a term that came 70 years later, this is like the definition of Machen's warrior children, with Murray Forrest Thompson and Cornelius Van Til on this committee of nine.
So were there two other figures that were more mediating figures? There weren't necessarily Ryan's top picks, but they also didn't prove to be in the minority.
Yeah, there was a ruling elder from Orange, New Jersey, Freetag. And the other one was R.B. Kuiper, who was got on the committee. But I think Kuiper – so what's fascinating with Kuiper is that
– did he ask to leave at some point? Maybe I'm imagining that. Because he did not vote in the minority eventually.
No, but I don't think so. So it's fascinating that we know a lot about the Committee of Nine, or one of the most enlightening reports is by Ed Herrema. Son-in-law. The son-in-law of R.B. Kuiper, who at the time the Calvin Forum was a four times a year paper out of Grand Rapids that talked about things within the Christian Reformed Church. They also, in every single issue of the Calvin Forum, had what they called the OPC correspondent or the Eastern correspondent. And the reason why they sometimes named it the Eastern correspondent, because they wanted to include news about Westminster Seminary. And so for the decade of the 40s, the correspondent to the Calvin Forum is Ed Herrema. And so, and Ed Herrema loved his father-in-law so much that he eventually wrote the great biography of R.B. Kuiper.
R.B. Prophet in the Land.
Prophet in the Land. So, so it's fascinating in that I don't think it's a stretch historically to say when you're reading Herrema, that is what R.B. Kuiper is thinking, or he's given it the approval or the sign-off. And so in 1941, at the report of the Committee on Nine in the Calvin Forum, Herrema gives this kind of like, yeah, we're going to see how this is. You know, this is something we're going to think about. We're going to do. And so that's how it reads in 1941. But in 1942, wow. Do you get a different report on the Committee of Nine in the Calvin Forum? And you see how much in a 12-month span, particularly after the meetings for the Committee of Nine started, and Fantail and Thompson found out what the true agenda was, that the whole thing shifted.
Now, real quick, Murray Forrest Thompson was an attorney, right? And he, I had done a review a few weeks ago on Reformed Media Review on his book, The Auburn Betrayal, which includes the full text of the Auburn Affirmation as well as a list of everyone who signed it to make sure it was memorialized and for everyone to remember into the future. Thompson probably was also the attorney that fought the case, or at least represented the OPC, the Presbyterian Church of America, in their suit against the PCUSA. But he was an elder at Calvary OPC in Glenside, correct? And that's where Van Til attended when he wasn't out doing pulpit supply.
At that time, Germantown,
yeah.
And then it moved to Glenside in 51.
Mm. So there we have two guys just through thick and thin. I mean, they're right on the same page and find themselves on a committee with some other folks that have a very different idea of what the church is and ought to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, but to me, the way I sometimes think about it is that the coalition that Machen put together to fight liberalism was one thing, and very thankful for all that joined. For instance, John mentioned Ockenguy, Harold Ockenguy was in the original classes at Westminster, and there he would have been classmates with a figure like Carl McIntyre, and they couldn't be any further apart.
They had two careers of building competing empires.
Right.
Where Ockenguy had Fuller, Christianity Today, and the National Association of Evangelicals. McIntyre had the American ACC, the Christian Beacon,
right.
And Faith Seminary.
Very good.
Two competing empires. Both shared one conviction that Westminster wasn't for them. The OPC wasn't for
them. Yeah, the OPC. But see, Machen was for them. Machen could hold them together. And so what happens was, after the 1936 and the new church is formed, and Machen dies, those fault lines become much more apparent. And so first there's the McIntyre departure, because the OPC was not going to be fundamentalist. We were not going to, on temperance, say something the Bible wasn't going to say. And on regard to the confession of faith that we were going to use, we wanted to use what was doctrinally, we believe, the best, not what would give us the best case in a civil court for church property in regard to continuity with the mainline church. And in regard to eschatology, we were going to have we're going to say that dispensationalism fractured the covenant of grace, right, and could not be an option for officers. And McIntyre couldn't live with that. Wongay had left prior to even the formation of the OPC. There's that great letter from the lady friend that Machen had, yeah, in Boston, and when she says to Machen, That guy from your seminary, the one with the funny name, he's now the pastor at Park Street. Yeah, sure. and so there's that great little thing. But if you put in his place Ed Ryan, you have the same type of aspiration in regard to what they were aspiring to be. And so now, for those who filled in behind Ed Ryan, it was a different coalition in the young church than those fundamentalists. So, for instance, I'm the fascinating figure is Robert Strong. He's the pastor of the largest OPC church at the time, Calvary OPC in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. And he is totally supportive of Ryan and this agenda. But at the same time, doctrinally, he's so all-mill, thoroughly all-mill in his eschatology, that he writes for like 6 months in The Guardian a series that's quite very well done on eschatology. So it's so vastly different from the fight of 36-37 in regard to the type of arguments that are going on. And he, at the time, was the pastor of Van Til. He was the pastor of Stonehouse. He was the pastor of Young. I mean, and there were certain things that they were committed to. They were all committed to Christian day schooling. So they all gathered together to start the Willow Grove Christian Day School, which soon thereafter became Philmont Christian Academy. Which
they even hired E.J. Young as a bus driver.
Yeah, right? Stonehouse and Young as your bus drivers are the greatest things going. I probably would have enrolled just to
ride to school.
And so
bus driver until Ralph Cramden came along.
Yeah, that's right. So the issue in 1941-42 is who doesn't love Robert Strong, you know, or the Southern graciousness of this. And so the issues are much more subtle, but yet at the same time it could not be any more dramatic, in that if you go down the line that Ed Ryan was wanting with the Committee of Nine, you were looking at a much broader church. It was going to be not primarily defined by Reformed confessionalism, even though he was confessional. I don't want to say Ryan wasn't confessional or he didn't, but he wanted to, he would have been the type that, let's don't put Orthodox Presbyterian in this name of this church. You know, let's just get them here first, and that's the most important thing, and then we will fill them in later. And Van Til was quite the opposite. This, the full-orbed Reformed faith is the gospel.
Yeah.
And this becomes the conflict.
Yeah, to put it, what Woolley would say in terms of linking the ambition of Ryan with the ambition of McIntyre was that, simply put, they wanted to read about themselves in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
That was a healthy church.
And in discontent, he contrasted that with confessional fidelity, faithfulness.
That was malignant discontent. and healthy discontent with those who aspire to see the church more faithful, more consistent in its expression of full orb Christianity. Mm. Ryan, you know, and Woolley put this in deliberately and exaggerated terms. You can have that healthy discontent, or you can read about yourself in the newspaper. You can't do both. Meaning you can't, you've got to choose one as your, as mm-hmm. your ambition.
Your master or something.
and to choose the former means to refuse to measure the health of the church in worldly categories.
Now there seems to be also some administrative aspect to this committee, not just the function of the committee, but in terms of their report. Help me understand that in terms of, it seemed as if they also wanted to structure what we call worldwide outreach right now in some way where there would be a master, almost like an executive committee that would govern all the other committees, one committee to rule them all. And wasn't that also a factor that played into the way this worked out at General Assembly?
Well, it certainly is patterning itself after what was viewed as the successful progression of the mainline church they just left, namely efficient organizational consolidation. Mm-hmm. This is the way the church makes an impact by meant entrusting some individuals with extraordinary power. In the PCUSA, the stated clerk becomes a bully pulpit. An office from which you can manipulate all kinds of control over the church. The general secretaries of the boards become bureaucrats.
Do you think we could get Robert Caro to write a book on the history of stated clerks in the Presbyterian churches?
I would be all in. I mean, I can't wait. I'm waiting, as you know, Camden, for that final volume on LBJ to come out. So I have that's definitely part of the argumentation that got the Committee of Nine defeated.
But they're seeing echoes of what they came out of.
Yeah.
And so I want to shout out here, whatever the proper applause would be, to Wayne Sparkman.
Yeah.
Just amazing job as PCA historian. And Wayne, through his labors, there's correspondence between Ed Ryan and Gordon Clark that's available. So what happened at the next General Assembly is that Ryan fell ill and was not actually there, which probably helped Fantil and Thompson win the day with their minority report. Mm-hmm. But this, in the aftermath, Gordon Clark wrote Ryan, and this is what he said. And this is immediately after that General Assembly. Clark said, "Your recent note reminds me that I intended to write to you about the time of General Assembly. It was somewhat of a shock to hear that you were not unable to go, and I hope that you are putting a great distance between you and any collapse. With sessions of the GA extending into the wee hours, I think one went till 3:30 in the morning. It is good you did not attend. The discontinuance of the Committee of Nine is quite a disappointment. On withdrawing my resolution, I wrote to all who had written to me urging them to support the Nine. Since it was not an administrative committee and could merely report to the Assembly, the objections made against it were preposterous. It would be excellent if the Reformed Alliance, or whatever it should be called, can be formed, and perhaps the Christian Education Committee has been improved, but the account of the whole assembly and the guarding was rather discouraging." And that's the nature of the correspondence between Ryan and Clark through this whole period, in that they were always maneuvering behind the scenes to try to get what they wanted.
They were organized.
Yeah, they were organizing. Mm-hmm. And that really becomes apparent also through the whole episode in which Clark realizes he's going to lose his job at Wheaton. As a matter of fact, Ryan writes an article in The Guardian about the whole episode of Wheaton getting rid of Clark, and they plan out that article months in advance and go back and forth on how it should appear in The Guardian. Yeah, it's all in the correspondence. That's why I would say Wayne Sparkman's the man doing this great service for us. But that brings up the figure of Gordon Clark. Mm-hmm. And he was very much at the center of the Committee of Nine. That's the, that's what some people really, have trouble wrapping their heads around, because Clark's getting fired at one institution for being too Calvinistic. And at another institution, he's throwing his weight behind someone who's wanting to broaden the church. Mm-hmm. And that becomes basically the background to the Clark-Fantil controversy. It was never simply about the incomprehensibility of God. It was also about the church.
The identity, the future of the church.
The future of the church. And so when Gordon Clark says to Ed Bryan in this June 27th, 1942 letter I just read, he said, perhaps the Christian Education Committee has been improved. He's referencing the fact that their great friend, Floyd Hamilton, is just being named General Secretary, and that the Christian Education Committee is now going to become their ally in this fight, because Hamilton becomes a very, very important figure in the next 5 years in this whole conflict. And at the end, in 1947-48, he becomes the pivotal figure after Clark, in which the whole thing gets resolved. But here's the first beginnings of it, where they're really happy that Hamilton, because Hamilton, along with Alan McCrae and others, was thoroughly convinced an alien element had gained control of both Westminster Seminary and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church.
Right. One of the goals of the group committed to the ordination of Gordon Clark was to bring Westminster Seminary eventually under denominational control. That's written in their agenda. Now, something else is going on here, Danny, and I should know the chronology better than I do. But while Wheaton takes his anti-Calvinistic turn, while Gordon Clark is losing a job, this is fueling the momentum for a Christian university.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, Ryan and Clark, during this whole period of time, are actually formulating the plans, because Clark is so desperate to get a new job.
Right, right. And this is fueling the sense that the time is now.
Yes.
Wheaton has closed its doors to a Reformed influence, and what better candidate for the faculty than Gordon Clark? Now, let me just speak.
In the faculty, you know who Ryan and Clark approached to help them with this? John Murray, because he was the least objectionable in regard to
right.
to the Dutchman.
Now, it's very interesting. It's very interesting that it was Murray and not Woolley.
Yes.
Because Woolley had definitely played his hand at this
point. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But just to speak personally here, we're getting into the late 40s. And my father, who is a graduate student in physics at Princeton, is already getting some feelers. They're looking for faculty. And he's getting correspondence
about the Christian University?
About keep this in mind. Keep this in mind. So they're looking at in all fields.
Yeah.
They're composing their faculty.
Wow.
Oh man, did your dad keep any of that correspondence?
I've got a little bit of it, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
I've actually got a letter also he wrote. Paul Woolley said said my father belonged at Belhaven College. There was a time when Belhaven was Woolley's best hope for a Christian college. Yes. And I would have been raised in Jackson, Mississippi if my father followed Paul Woolley's advice.
So you'd be rooting for the Atlanta Braves now instead of the Mets.
And I'd be in the PCA. Yeah,
that's right. You would have had a better 90s.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We won't go there.
Yeah. Well, I mean baseball.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. I know. Exactly. We will not go there.
Oh, goodness. It's all in good fun. So let's go back to, was it the 42 General Assembly where the report came back? And you mentioned Ryan is ill and unable to attend. And we not only have this report from the committee, so for people that might not know how all of these things work, we have this committee who issues a report, and you could debate it, discuss it. If the report has any recommendations, then those come as motions from the committee, and you could deliberate those things. But not only do we have a report that could be debated and deliberated, we also have a minority report. So those happen occasionally, not too frequent, but they're not unusual. So how does a minority report function? And then tell us who presented it and how was it different?
Yeah, the Minority Report is something. So when you back then in the OPC, you did not have advisory committees, but this special committee, they had a majority report, a minority report, and you would basically get the opportunity on the floor to read your report. And then what would happen is that you would move one of them. And then probably whichever one was moved, let's say the majority report was moved, then someone would move a substitute for the minority report. And like John's childhood pastor, John Hills, would always do that. You know, Hills would believe you always want to speak positively towards what you wanted to pass and not negative. So that's what happens is that the minority report of Cornelius Van Til and Thompson gets before the church, and it wins the day because they actually get to, I believe that what happened really helped define the direction of the OPC, and I'm so thankful for it. They said, yes, we must have a witness.
Well, they presented, I think it was 9 theses of sorts, if I'm not mistaken, and they were in agreement on many. Yeah. But in just the function of a minority report, you have Thompson and Van Til as members of this committee. So you might have disagreements and you might lose as the minority and the committee goes and does something you don't like. But there's a provision within Robert's Rules of Order where if you feel very strongly about something and you're in the minority, you can present your own report. And then the body can decide. And just because you were in the minority of the little committee doesn't necessarily mean you're in the minority of the larger body. And so we have here then these 2 competing reports, one of them coming from Cornelius Van Til and Murray Forrest Thompson, the other coming from the rest of the members of the committee. But they're not, I mean, in large measure, they're really in agreement on a lot of things, but it seems that Van Til and Thompson had struck at least 2 of those items out.
And, well, wasn't it the case that the minority report also included the recommendation to discontinue the committee?
Yeah, they sure did.
So it wasn't like we have 2 different directions in which
no,
this committee
this has
can
a
go.
Terminus.
No,
yeah.
We can continue or we can just end this bad idea right now.
Right.
Yeah.
But all the good, but they weren't, it wasn't a total trashing of the minority report.
No,
yeah,
no. Here's,
explain that, please.
So
thanks.
Here's really the basic difference. Van Til and Thompson wanted it to be a reformed witness. Mm-hmm. It wanted it to be a reformed ecumenicity. It wanted it to be reformed evangelism. And so, for instance, they come back and say, let's work with other reformed churches to have an ecumenical body, which eventually became the part of the Reformed Ecumenical Synod. In the late 40s that we joined. That's so much different between working with the then Christian Reformed Church, the Covenanters, the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. It's so much different working with them versus working with the NAE and all the evangelical churches from the wide spectrum, from Baptists to Charismatics to others. It's a
the group that, you know, 12, 13 years ago, just for people to know, had a great scandal with the president, Ted Haggard. That's the same group.
Right.
That's
right.
What we're talking about,
and so,
that breadth.
And so, see, Van Til saying is that, look, we're not saying the gospel isn't found in these evangelical groups, but in regard to ecclesiastically working with groups, we do not want to, we're not going to be inviting to our pulpits people who speak in tongues or handle snakes or don't follow the biblical guidelines for ordination in regard to who can be, you know. And so we're not going to do that, but we do want to have witness. We do want to have evangelism. We want to be aggressive about it. So it was the nature of the direction of the church. And so out of that then came the great evangelism report that the General Assembly conducted in regard to what are the principles of Reformed evangelism. But this is one of the most major directions, you know, decisions in the history of our church in regard to, is the Reformed faith just a part of the evangelical world that has its own little corner, or is the Reformed faith we believe the gospel, the most consistent expression of the gospel, not to say that the gospel is not found in other communions, but what is the nature of the Reformed faith? That was the essence of the debate.
Right. Perhaps leaning back to the Westminster Confession's comment about churches that are more or less pure, thinking along those lines.
And Thompson and Van Til call the majority, the spirit behind the majority report, bureaucratic and un-Presbyterian, which is a twist on the claim that Van Til represents an alien element to American Presbyterianism. This is Presbyterianism, and you're betraying what you claim to be stewarding if you go in this direction.
And we have in the middle of this, not as a member of the committee, but to pull this back full circle to some degree, the guy who probably has the best claim personally to the American Presbyterian element, who comes down at least sympathetically and philosophically and theologically with Thompson and Van Til, Paul Woolley.
Right, right. And I'd also say, you know, this wasn't a matter, the success of Van Til and Thompson wasn't simply killing a bad idea, but the product of this was to forge that distinctively Reformed identity in, like, the report on evangelism, in participation in RES. So it actually does have a positive outcome. It gives clarity to what is that Reformed direction, that better part of the American Presbyterian tradition to which the OPC claims to be the spiritual successor. This is what it's going to look like.
Now, to speak a little bit, just indulge me for just a brief moment on some personal biography. But I've greatly enjoyed being involved with Mid-America Reformed Seminary over the last 6, 7, 8 years, both as just a minister nearby and someone who likes to go there and hang out, someone who served as an adjunct professor a couple times, someone who serves on the board now, and more significantly, a pastor of two former students. But one thing I've greatly appreciated about getting to know the brothers down there, and that's a Reformed seminary, but it serves the URC, the OPC, the PCA, the RCUS, the RCNZ. It serves a wide range. It's one of the most, it's a small seminary, but it truly is one of the most ecumenical in terms of the students that come out of there. And I have just personally appreciated, I would call it the tempering, or perhaps, you know, the mixing of this, of an alloy, this continental influence of a Reformed tradition upon me, who has no personal experience whatsoever with the continental Reformed tradition in terms of churches where I've worshiped, you know, personal influences in my life. So getting to know many of the URC and RCUS brothers involved in the seminary down there has been helpful to me, and it actually caused me to appreciate more deeply my American Presbyterianism. And I think they would probably say the same thing, not for me specifically, but from the OPC and healthy PCA influences, ARP and others, that the Continental Brothers there, they're not looking to leave their continental churches, but they, I don't want to speak for them, but I would not be surprised at all that they would say that their appreciation of their own church traditions and confessions has also been strengthened and encouraged and bolstered by their personal experience with Presbyterians. So where this comes back in, it's a thesis I would love to look into more and to hear both of you brothers reflect on this. But for me to see a figure like a Gerhardus Voss, being a Dutch figure, speaking German, viewed as an alien element at Princeton, becoming a European and an immigrant who eventually comes to be truly, you know, a confessional Presbyterian. He's thought to be a Presbyterian among some groups as some kind of a representative. He's at Princeton. And then to see these alien influences, you know, using that derogatory term, of Van Til, you know, of all people, being his biographer, of his Dutch roots, significant Dutch roots and a tremendous pedigree, but then also to become in many ways a leader of an American Presbyterian movement in this way. Ned Stonehouse, R.B. Kuyper, to some degree, John Murray. But these figures, I think, in many ways shape and direct the direction of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church as a distinctive form, not the only form, but a distinctive form of American Presbyterianism, not just by their theological writings and actions, but it's also just their disposition. And I think the soil out of which they grow, they bring, I think, a helpful element to the OPC, where I'm not so sure things would have gone the same way if we didn't have those Continental brothers. I don't know what that would have looked like. It's a counterfactual. These are things we can ruminate on, perhaps. But it's an interesting point, and I think one that should not be overlooked. This alien influence is not a wrinkle or a defect in the OPC, but I believe it should be viewed as a great strength,
right,
and an advantage.
Right. And, you know, maybe a contemporary example is the way in which we were all sort of surprised at a unintended consequence of the production of the Trinity Psalter hymn book.
Mm.
The proximity we realized we had with the URCNA, and how we can partner in this important venture and perhaps others in advancing the Reformed faith, borrowing from the strengths of each other. This is ecumenicity of a very powerful sort. That's not organizational union, which many people cannot imagine how you could be genuinely ecumenical if you're not organizationally united.
Yeah, right.
And that is really a deficient view of the promises and possibilities of ecumenicity.
Mm-hmm.
And the OPC at its best has modeled, I think, a really robust form of ecumenicity through its faithful leadership in organizations like ICRC. You're not going to read about them in the papers.
NAPARC, yeah.
But mm-hmm. they're doing quiet work of conducing towards the unity of Christ Church.
Amen. Let me stir the pot just a little bit, and we can edit this out. But just to connect some dots for folks who might be wondering about the lessons of the 40s and how they might apply today. I think some of the movements of the 40s in this kind of, I don't know, high watermark of evangelicalism, neo-evangelicalism, the organizations are different in that the National Association of Evangelicals is not just something that you put a badge on your website and say, I find affinity with this organization. You actually have member churches. So you have denominations that are in one way, shape, or form taking official steps to join this organization. I don't know if there were dues exchanged or something like that, but it is more formal. Nevertheless, you do find some elements of the parachurch now that are not the same. Perhaps they've evolved. Perhaps they're doing something different. Perhaps with our marketing and consumerist culture, the forms have changed. Nevertheless, they're serving a lot of the function that a figure like Edwin Ryan would, an ambitious figure, would want to see served if he were alive today. And the groups like the Gospel Coalition, which is not a denomination. It doesn't necessarily pretend to be one, but in many ways functions as kind of a unified witness place where there are like-minded people that try to gather together and perform some of this larger influence and have this bigger platform that none of the individuals could necessarily have. And it's also a place where you find a lot of movers and shakers that have their own mega platforms still gathering together to do things together. There are other groups, Together for the Gospel and other places where you find cooperation of this sort. But to me, it's interesting just to ruminate perhaps and think about how a figure like Ryan, Gordon Clark, what they might think of today and what the similarities would be and where they might find differences in the way things operate in 2021.
I guess when you asked that question, the figure that came to my mind was R.B. Kuiper. And that in 1946, we had the 10th anniversary of the OPC. And at the 10th anniversary banquet, they had R.B. Kuiper speak. And he gave an address on why the Orthodox Presbyterian.
What's right with the Orthodox Presbyterian Church,
which was the answer to Ryan and to Clark and others.
Right.
And the sense you get out of that talk is that, and Kuiper also had a follow-up, on this theme, but let the church be the church. That's what we're called to. Let the church be the church, preaching of the word, ministration of the sacraments, and proper exercise of discipline. That's what we're called to. Let's do that faithfully. And these other things will take care of themselves. Like, these other things cannot be primary. Otherwise, you have really harmed what the church is called to be. And I think in Kuiper's own way, he was saying, look, if we don't let the church be the church, then what Machen stood for is really in peril. Because in Christian liberalism, the book ends with the chapter on the church, where it's all driving to. And that's, I think, part of the lesson here when you talk about the Gospel Coalition and everything that's happening today. I actually think Ryan and Clark might be a little taken back, although it's almost like their thoughts gone to seed a little bit. But I think, Kuiper's the one that really formulates to me what the outcome of this is and where we should be headed.
And what's brilliant about Kuiper's piece is that he turns on its head the terms narrow and broad, because Clark and Ryan, their complaint was that the OPC was too narrow and we needed a broader vision. Clark famously observed in the pages of the Presbyterian Guardian that the OPC had become a porcupine, an isolated porcupine. Well, Kuiper says that a Reformed ecclesiology is a broader church. A less than Reformed ecclesiology is a narrower church on issues like Christian liberty and others. And to let the church be the church is to have the broadest vision of the work of the church. It's not restricting its vision. It's freeing the church to do what it's called to do. So he really, he claims we're broad in the best sense of the word. We are narrow in the best sense of the word. I think very important qualifications.
It's helpful to be reminded of that, and that aggressiveness of that outreach and seeking to help and fellowship as much as possible with those with whom we can, rather than being a porcupine in a corner defensive, but never compromising on witness or sacrificing on confessional fidelity, but at the same time being winsome and open and forthright in our outreach and evangelism. That's really something to think about. You guys have any suggested reading on perhaps some of this topic? These topics, we can put links to things we've already mentioned, and of course some of the correspondence between Clark and Buswell and whatnot can be found at the PCA Historical Archives at pcahistory.org, if I'm not mistaken, in the Gordon Clark Archives. And of course, the Presbyterian Guardian article by Paul Willey, Discontent, and I'll have a link to the episode where we discussed this a few years ago.
One thing I would suggest, the minority managed to put an end to the ambition of the Committee of Nine, and Ryan and Clark would leave the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. But their spirit didn't leave, and there was still some voices, milder voices of uncertainty and even discontent in the decades that follow. And a book that very helpfully discusses that is Darrell's book on the middle years of the OPC, Between the Times. Mm-hmm. And that would be a good follow-up on this, to hear, is to see how these are recurring challenges before the church, how it witnesses to a full-orbed Reformed faith, and where it finds the dangers in cooperating with broader Reformed elements. Darrell sort of takes that into the subsequent decades.
The two articles I'd recommend, this one is Michael Hackenberg, the Ordination of Gordon Clark?
Yes.
In Pressing Towards the Mark, Essays Commemorating the 50th Anniversary of the OPC. I believe that's available online at opc.org. in a PDF form, but that is an excellent article that Hackenberg has there. And also in John and Daryl's book, Fighting the Good Fight, the chapter at the end of the book on the social witness of the church is also, I think, a key article or chapter to read in that regard. And then there's now stuff, amazing stuff online. The Calvin Forum, the Christian Reformed Church, has the archives of the Calvin Forum from the 1940s, and that's just wonderful reading.
And the Guardian. So, you can read the whole Guardian archives at opc.org. Links to that. You can download the whole thing. It's under 2 gigabytes PDF form. It's really useful.
And don't forget the in Fighting the Good Fight, we let Machen have the last word with his responsibility of the church in our new age, which is the responsibility of the church in any age.
Yeah. Right.
When he lays out all the foundations of what Van Til and Thompson and Woolley were fighting for, about the identity of the church and the right understanding of its mission. Mm-hmm. I would second the recommendation about Hackenberg's article, because he really lays out the broader agenda. You know, too many people look at the Clark Van Til controversy as two eggheads who couldn't talk to each other.
But reading Van Til's letters, which you have done, he's corresponding with his colleagues, and there were multiple occasions in which he had Clark to his house, and they would have a dialogue for 8 hours straight, and Van Til would cover the theological issues with him. This wasn't the case of Van Til just being some sort of stickler and not putting in the time or misunderstanding Clark. He went over and above, over the top in interacting with Clark and seeking to win him over.
And Clark respected him, even while he dissented. They were cordial. They weren't close, but they remained cordial. They were careful. Both were careful not to speak ill of the other. But what Hackenberg demonstrates is that there was from the start a larger agenda that was a battle over the soul of the OPC, that you cannot disengage from this controversy. Mm. It wasn't an epistemological disagreement between two Christian philosophers. And Hackenberg's article makes that absolutely clear with documentation. What's fascinating is that he wrote that, let me think if I have this right. He wrote that as a Calvin College student under George Marsden.
Yes. Yeah.
And Clark was incensed by it and wrote a long letter to Hackenberg highlighting all his errors, to which George Marsden responded. And Marsden basically said, "Let me show you what a careful historian Hackenberg was," and basically vindicated the work of his student.
Well, we are back. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. It was a little longer from some of our typical episodes, but I was enjoying it. So I hope you did as well, and that the time passed, you got in the zone and really enjoyed discussing all of those wonderful figures, Paul Woolley, the Committee of Nine, and Cornelius Van Til, Murray Forrest Thompson, Edwin Ryan, all of these figures. It is significant understanding the dynamics there and really the formation of and the setting the tone for the church moving forward. It was an important and critical time in the life of the OPC, but I trust that you were able to see many of the connections and the touch points that are useful for many other denominations and just the church as it relates to the culture and the academy and wider acceptance and prestige that may be desired. We are a pilgrim people, and we need to remember those lessons and keep moving forward in that pilgrimage, understanding that this earthly wilderness wandering is not our home. We're delighted also to have other opportunities to serve. In 2 days from when I'm recording this, I'll be heading out to Colombia in South America, not South Carolina, heading out with one of our board members, the Reverend Douglas Clausen. So please pray for both of us as we go down to serve churches in Colombia, Reformed churches that the OPC has established relationships with, and the denomination has been sending people down for several years through something called the Mobile Theological Mentoring Corps, and it's a wing or a ministry of our Committee on Foreign Missions. And last year I was able to teach a course on Roman Catholicism, but my trip was canceled because of the pandemic. Nevertheless, I was able to teach remotely through Zoom. But this year, Lord willing, well, everything's looking okay, but I'm going to be able to go in person and teach that course on Roman Catholicism again, but in a different city to different people, and then to teach a course on Lamentations, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah to the brothers and sisters I was able to teach remotely with last year. So please pray for our travels. Pray that the Lord would bless our efforts and our labors, and most of all, that Christ would be honored in whatever we do, and that we would have the strength and energy to accomplish the work that he sets before us. I'm excited, but we need your prayers. So thanks so much for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum. Please consider heading on over to reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your financial support. We are in need. We're doing well. We are excited. We are encouraged, but we are always in need of additional financial support. So if you have the means and the opportunity and the desire to do that, along with supporting your own churches and other things that are in that are significant in your life, then please head on over to our website as well. But I do want to thank you for listening and watching, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.